Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball, host of Milk Street Radio. If you'd like to change the way you cook and also think about food, please check out the Milk Street podcast. We travel around the world to find pizza in Tokyo, Egyptian food in Berlin, and Bhutanese farmers in Vermont. We speak to Jamie Oliver, Rachel Ray, Al Roker, Ina Garten, as well as Michael Twitty, Marcus Samuelson, and Alice Waters. And we'll introduce you to recipes that will change the way you cook, from bright pink Tottenham cake to Afghan dumplings to shoyu sugar steak, and that one is direct from Hawaii. It's a whole new world of food right here on Milk Street Radio. Please check us out on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts, or go to 177milkstreet.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome. This is another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year. That was a stupid thing to say. But anyway, Matt's there somewhere in his
yes, I am.
With the worst Wi-Fi in the world because very few things change.
Correct.
And even though we've got to the end of a very tricksy period, well, we haven't got to the end of it because the pandemic is continuing in various forms, he still hasn't got a decent Wi-Fi. But anyway, Matt, are you there? Is everything poised and ready?
It is as poised as it's ever going to be. I'm looking forward to my Wi-Fi failing within about 20 minutes. Okay. So let's crack on.
And today we're talking to Jonathan Friedland about The Escape Artist. It says on the front, an immediate classic. This is according to Anthony Beaver. And delighted to say Jonathan Friedland joins us from his luxurious... I think you're in your kitchen, I think, and we're looking, I can just see your garden. Would that be right?
You are broadly right, yeah. I'm in a sort of corner, which I've positioned in such a way that I'm surrounded by cushions and various blankets to keep the acoustic studio-like, but yes, you can get a little glimpse there.
It's where so much radio has come from people's houses and homes over the last couple of years. We've all sort of got used to the fact that this is a way of doing it in the future. It's always good to speak to you, Jonathan. We're speaking to you as Jonathan Friedland and not as Sam Bourne. Your book is The Escape Artist. Matt is going to describe the cover before we get any further. Matt, describe this book by its cover.
So it's an overwhelmingly dark cover, other than the title, which is in big, bold, yellow letters, The Escape Artist. But three quarters of the front of the book is just black, with right at the bottom you have a ribbon picture of the train track leading up to Auschwitz, which many people will be familiar with. But then, as I say, The Escape Artist in gold, painted almost on wood in the middle of the page. The man who broke out of Auschwitz to warn the world, Jonathan Friedland.
Jonathan, tell us who was The Escape Artist.
This is the story of Rudolf Werber, his name was. I always say Werber just because it sounds so weird to keep pronouncing it the absolutely accurate way. But he was one of the very tiny group of Jews who escaped from Auschwitz. He did it when he was 19 years old. He did it alongside a fellow prisoner, also like him from Slovakia, a man called Fred Wetzler. They escaped in April 1944. They were, in fact, the first Jews to break out, physically break out of the camp and make their way to freedom. No one had ever pulled off that feat before. And as the book says on, the subtitle on the cover of the book, as described by Matt, says he did it for a reason. He did it to warn the world. They did it to warn the world, and particularly actually to warn their fellow Jews of what fate awaited them at Auschwitz, because at that point, hardly anybody knew. And there were even the word Auschwitz, which now is so familiar and part of the global language, part of the global imagination, even that word was not known when they did it. So it's about somebody who pulled off one of the great escapes. I've read quite a few of these wartime escapes. You probably, like me, grew up with the Great Escape movie with Steve McQueen and Escape from Colditz on TV. to my mind, having read quite a few of them, I think this is the most extraordinary escape, partly because the security on and the way a Jew was guarded in Auschwitz was tighter and more severe than for anybody else. But also, they for this driving purpose that Wetzler and Werber had makes it of such great import, the reason they did it and their warning to the world.
How did you come across this story, Jonathan? And maybe you could also hint, or maybe you could tell us at the same time as to why you think we haven't known about this story before.
Well, I came across it such a long time ago when, I mean, Werber was 19 when he escaped, and I was 19 when I first heard his story. Because I went to see the 9.5 hour long epic documentary made by Claude Lanzmann called Shoah, which came out in 1985-86. I saw it in a London cinema in 1986. It was in two parts. You would go on successive days. And it's a long, painful, difficult, but extraordinary film. You know, you might talk about it one day on your other show. I mean, it's just an extraordinary piece of cinema. But there's one person who, to me, as a 19-year-old at the time, kind of exploded off the screen. There's no archive in the film. It's just made up of interviews. There's a succession of interviewees who, to me, then age 19, looked like very old men. When I watch it now, I realize they weren't so old, actually. But they looked like old, kind of broken, defeated men and women. And then somebody pops up on the screen who kind of explodes off the screen because he looks way younger than the rest. He's tanned. He's handsome. He's wearing this kind of tan leather coat. He looks like Al Pacino in Scarface or something. And it's he's in Manhattan. The others are interviewed in Polish, in Poland or in Germany or in Czechoslovakia. He's there in, you know, New York City, and he's got this really amazing screen presence and charisma. And the film mentions almost in passing, actually, it's not the main purpose of the film, that this Jewish man escaped from Auschwitz. And I, even at 19, knew enough about Auschwitz and the Holocaust to know that Jews didn't really escape from Auschwitz. That was unbelievable that somebody had done that. The film talks about then other things. It gets into the fact that Werber had been in Auschwitz for 2 years, very nearly 2 years, which is itself extraordinary and exceptional. Most Jews who arrived at Auschwitz, their life expectancy was measured in hours. If they were in the concentration camp as opposed to death camp, if they were in the concentration camp part of Auschwitz, used as slaves, their life would be in weeks and months. For somebody to have been there 2 years made him exceptional, and that's in fact why Lanzmann wanted to talk to him, because he had this extraordinary 360-degree panoramic view of the world of Auschwitz, because he'd been there so long and worked in almost every part of it. So that's what he talks about. That lodged in my mind. Even as a 19-year-old, I thought, well, that I want to know more about that person and how he did that. And then your other question, why is it that he wasn't well-known, is fascinating, because in the 35 years that passed between me seeing that film and now, you know, he's hardly mentioned. I mean, he hardly appeared. He wasn't really interviewed anywhere else. He didn't give great speeches that were to huge audiences. You know, he didn't win the Nobel Peace Prize like Elie Wiesel. He wasn't famous international writer like Primo Levi. He was known to a few specialist historians. He's there in the footnotes. You know, he's mentioned every now and again. But my best guess, as to which we may come on to talk about, as to why he was not well known, is his story. The story I hope you know you and I might talk about now. Is that was uncomfortable. It was inconvenient, and he ended up pointing the finger, an accusing finger, in a few difficult and awkward directions. And I think that's that plus his personal manner. He was a very angry man, and he wouldn't do what I think we often expect of Holocaust survivors, which is to be this soothing, healing, uplifting presence who bestow on us kind of wisdom that they've gained through suffering. You know, you listen to media interviews with the dwindling number of Holocaust survivors now, and they're treated with, as rightly, with great reverence, but almost as if they're the kind of Dalai Lama or something, that they're going to give some sort of almost self-help wisdom, improving wisdom. Verba wouldn't do that. And I found, even in the archive, a letter from Verba to a BBC TV producer where he says, I should warn you, I will not be the cliched Holocaust survivor. You know, he was aware himself. He was an angry, difficult, scratchy guy. And he would not give you the comfortable narrative that people want. We may get into why his account was uncomfortable.
I think, yeah, we definitely want to get into him delivering a message to the world and the world perhaps not wanting to listen. I have to begin by saying this, Jonathan. This is an astonishing piece of work. There's something I want to share with you. I was listening to a podcast about books a couple of weeks ago, which is obviously vastly inferior to this one, but still a podcast about books. And the author was asked at the end of it, she was asked, you know, are there any books that you're reading at the moment, any that you'd recommend? And verbatim, this is what she said. She said, well, I'm going to read The Escape Artist like everyone else. And it was, there are two things to say there. One is the like everyone else, which is always nice to hear as an author. But the other is she didn't need to explain what The Escape Artist was. She didn't say, I'm going to be reading Jonathan Friedland's book about the guy who escaped from Auschwitz and told the world. The Escape Artist. She just said, The Escape Artist. And it struck me hearing that, and I was in the middle of reading your book when I heard that interview, and it struck me straight away, this feels like a career-defining book that you've written here. Now, I've read plenty of your other books, and we've been lucky enough to have you on the podcast as Sam Bourne for the thrillers that you've done. But I absolutely have been bowled over by this piece of work. And I suppose this is like one of my questions to when we had Ian Rankin on. Ian, how do you write books so well? You're so great. So my question to you, Jonathan, is does this feel like a career-defining work to you?
Well, Matt, that's incredibly generous. I'm really, you know, a bit blown away myself by you saying all that. And genuinely, that means a lot for me to hear that, because you know, this was harder than anything else I've had to write. Not for the obvious reasons. I think some people think it must have been so hard because it was about the Holocaust. What was so hard about it for me was, and it is related to the fact that it was the Holocaust, but first of all, because it was non-fiction rather than fiction, I found that I was almost midway through every sentence, stopping, checking, double checking, then going back. And, you know, you as people who write or are involved in a business like this will know that a big important thing about what we all do is sometimes to get a flow and get momentum and to not stop and start all the time. And with Sam Bourne books, sometimes I would really get on a roll where it was just flowing and I was almost like in a trance doing it. This was not like that. Here, every four or five words, I would have to say, hang on a minute. This account says he was 200 yards from that place, but I've got one over here that says 180 yards. Let me now get the map out. And, I see why, because that barrack moved in 1943. You know, I was doing this sort of thing, and therefore it was very, it felt sort of juddering at the time faltering. And I had genuine worries about, is this going to work? Because it didn't feel like anything I'd done before. Partly why I was doing that was I felt this huge obligation to be as scrupulously accurate as I could be, and to make, because it's the Holocaust and there are people who deny the Holocaust. And I didn't want anybody going to be able to say, well, hang on, that doesn't match up, and therefore we can't rely on the whole thing, you know. And so I was obsessively meticulous. There will be mistakes in there because human beings make mistakes. So I say that now. I'm not claiming that, you know, this is somehow flawless. But certainly, you know, nothing of any import has been pointed out so far. And my hope is that I've got it right. But that meant it felt very, very different. But you know, where you say career defining, I mean, it has done well and it's been in the bestsellers list. It is now as we're speaking, and that is hugely gratifying. But mainly, I think it was this feeling that this was a story that was really like no other. I almost myself couldn't believe it as I was going through the material, how amazing this story was, and in a way that people hadn't really put it all the pieces together and told it before. You know, Verbe himself did write a memoir in 1963, and that takes you more or less up to the escape, a little bit of afterwards, but not really much. And obviously there was so much he didn't know, which is funny to say that about someone writing their own life story. But there have been lots of archives opened and papers, so he could only know about it from his own point of view. I was able to look at all the kind of archives and stuff around the world that, and documents that have come to light since. And I was able to interview, you know, he was married twice, and I was lucky enough to interview both women. His widow, his second wife, is still alive and in the United States, and she was Robin Verbe, who was a wonderful help and filled in tons of things that he himself had not put in his autobiography written, you know, nearly 60 years ago. And then I, you know, through amazing luck, also got to talk to his first wife, who had been his childhood sweetheart and who knew him before Auschwitz. And she, you know, I can say more about that too. But between them and all the documents and everything else, the story got just fuller and fuller and bigger and bigger. And yes, in a way, there were moments where I thought, look, this is the most important thing I've ever written.
At the heart of the book, so you start the book with the escape. So it's April 1944. Can you tell us, Jonathan, once that escape has been successful, I found myself wanting to know, so he escapes to Slovakia. What is happening in Slovakia? Is it a Nazi satellite state? Because this is where he has gone to tell his story. And obviously how his story is, and he writes this report, and how the lessons that are learned and how long it takes for anyone to do anything at all is very important to you telling the story. But who's in charge of Slovakia, and who are the people who he is explaining what is happening in Auschwitz to?
This is, by the way, is why people love coming on this podcast, because there are never any spoilers, and that's brilliant, because you haven't asked me, as some people have, to try and spoil the story of the escape, which, you know, I really do like holding back for, because it is, I think, you know, pretty extraordinary. And as you say, they then, you know, even once out of Auschwitz, it's not over for them, because they have to cross Nazi-occupied Poland, which they takes them, you know, crossing marshlands and forests and mountains and rivers with, as Verbe later said, no map, no compass, no friends. They have no contacts in the outer world. There's no resistance to help them because they're Jews. And they have to travel at night, not at day. You know, it's how they do it is amazing. But they make it back to Slovakia, their home country. And their determination then is to make contact with the remnant Jewish community. So to answer your question, exactly as you say, it was a Nazi satellite state, a fascist-run state, an ally of Adolf Hitler's and Nazi Germany. It had not yet been occupied. It would be later on in 1944. The Germans would actually then enter and occupy it with boots on the ground. At that stage, they don't need to, because the regime is so pro-Nazi, to the point where it was kind of, you know, more royal than the king. You know, it was more eager to persecute and pursue Jews than even Nazi Germany itself. The first deportations from anywhere to Auschwitz were from Slovakia. It was run by, incredibly, a fascist leader who is also a Catholic priest, Father Josef Tiso, or Tiso. And yeah, that regime had passed Nuremberg-style laws, meaning discriminatory laws against Jews, while Rudolf Verbe was, you know, 14, 15, 16. He, you know, was a very, very bright young boy who had gotten to one of the very best high schools in Bratislava, and turned up for school one day in September 1938, and was told, you no longer have a place at this school. No Jews are allowed anymore. And, you know, the rules, I chart how the rules and new regulations were passed almost week by week, day by day. Jews weren't allowed to own radios. They weren't allowed to own sports equipment. They couldn't travel beyond a certain number of miles without a permit, and that number of miles would get smaller. You know, their lives were more and more restricted, until essentially there was a policy of officially sanctioned looting, where Slovak non-Jews could more or less you know, in these various paramilitary groups could arrive at a Jewish home and say, right, we're having that, you know, and they would. They would just walk in and take, in one case, a grand piano. They just walked out with it. But it culminates in deportation. And in the early spring of 1942, when Rudy's just 17, Jews are loaded onto trains. The order comes to go. And Rudy, incidentally, refuses to do that. And that's why I called the book partly The Escape Artist, is he's a serial escapologist. He keeps on escaping, both before and after Auschwitz. So he tries to escape the deportation, you know. But eventually he doesn't, obviously, and arrives in Auschwitz on the last day of June in 1942. The interesting thing, again, something he did not know about and could not have known about, is there was a pause in the deportations. And that is why there was still a remnant Jewish community left. Tiny community. We're talking about the whole Slovak Jewry was about 89,000 people. And most of them, about 60-odd thousand, were deported in 1942. That left 20-odd thousand who were still there. They thought the deportations had ended. The Slovak Jewish leadership thought that they had successfully bribed the officials to halt the deportations. Little did they know it was merely a pause for the Slovak and the Nazis' own reasons, which the book gets into. But it was only a pause. It's in the period of that pause that Rudy and Fred escape. And so there are still some Jews left in Slovakia who are clinging on. Huge discrimination. Their lives absolutely circumscribed, but they are alive. And so they make contact with the Slovak Jewish leadership, such as it was, and they find their way to a basement of what had been a Jewish old age home in the small Slovak town of Žilina. And there, hiding in a basement, Rudy and Fred, they pour out the eyewitness testimony that they have been, again, another incredible thing, methodically accumulating and memorizing. Rudy particularly had the most extraordinary memory. And so they sort of, you know, verbally download everything they have been, this data they've been collecting in their head. And somebody from the Jewish community there, a lawyer, an engineer, and backed by a lawyer, they sit down and methodically write it all down. And it becomes this 32-page, single-spaced report, which at that point is the most detailed account of Auschwitz-Birkenau that had ever been written anywhere in the world, because people only had fragments of rumour and bits of testimony. Suddenly they have a full account, and that report would then embark on a kind of escape of its own, which the book charts. Yes. But Slovakia was in that strange place.
Sorry, Jonathan, but nothing happens for quite a long time. So maybe you could explain, as you've told us who it is that they're downloading this information to, why does it take such a long time for anything to happen as a result of this report?
Yeah, I mean, I should say from the start, something really big does happen as a result of this report. And again, it is why I think Rudolf Werber deserves to be ranked alongside, you know, Primo Levi, Oskar Schindler, Anne Frank, you know, the names that define our understanding of the Holocaust, because something really big does happen, and we'll come to that. But he believed that the moment he got the word out, everything would change, and that the killing in Auschwitz, which by that period, the spring of 1944, would get to a rate of 12 to 15,000 Jews are murdered there every single day. He believed that the proof that the world did not know about it, he thought, was the fact that it was happening. Because it was obvious to him that if the world knew, they would not be allowing this thing to happen. So he assumed that he would just say the words, the report would get typed up, and it would stop the next day or the day after. And it proved very naive. The report had to go on its own journey, which it did, in secret, and it was passed hand to hand, person to person, you know, across borders of occupied Europe. I chart there. I think my book is the first time the journey of the report has ever been charted and all put together in one place. But it does make its way to the desk of Winston Churchill in London, to the desk of Franklin Roosevelt in Washington, and the Pope in Rome. They all get it. And by then, attached to it is a plea from Jewish leaders, even outside Slovakia, but also inside, saying, you have to bomb the railway tracks to Auschwitz because, you know, the Auschwitz is essentially a killing factory, a death factory, which is producing, you know, ash, human ash and smoke at a rate of 15,000 human beings a day. Therefore, if this is a factory, take out the conveyor belt, you know, bomb the railway tracks. And, you know, to his credit, Churchill says to his Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden, raise this with the Air Force, get anything out of the Air Force you can, invoke me if necessary. The head of the Air Ministry, Air Force, says this is not practical. We can't do it because we bombed during the night and the Americans, this would require bombing during the day. Talk to the Americans. You know, it goes through all the bureaucracy of Washington, this department, that department. It takes a week to be, you know, cabled to this desk rather than that desk. Each day, you know, thousands are dying, but they are taking their time and they have meetings and they talk about it. And in the end, you know, Roosevelt himself says he doesn't want to have any part of it because that he feels if in the process of bombing Jews get killed, then somehow the Americans would be complicit, in effect, in the Holocaust. Not that anyone's calling it that at that point. So it's partly practical, it's partly prejudice. There were bureaucrats who read this report in London and said, I think we've heard enough of these wailing Jews, or, you know, we've got to allow for a certain degree of Jewish exaggeration, etc. So nothing happens in terms of that military ask. As it happens, Verba and Wetzel themselves, Verba in particular, that wasn't really the prime concern. Their prime goal was get this word out to Jews themselves, because one of Rudolf Verba's jobs in Auschwitz was working literally on the railway platform, the ramp, known as the Alte Judenrampe, the old Jew ramp, where Jewish, that's what the Nazis called it, where each train would arrive. And his job was unloading those cattle trucks that were packed with Jewish deportees from all points across the continent, Belgium, Holland, France, Germany, Austria, you know, Slovakia, what we would now call the Czech Republic, etc. They were all Greece, you know, they were all brought there. And he every day saw these people getting off, and he saw them getting off in relatively orderly fashion. And he understood, he had this great penetrating insight, even as a 17, 18-year-old, he realized that the core element of the Nazi method was deception. That it was because they had been lied to that they were, and because they believed that they were going to be resettled for new lives, not murdered, you know. That's why they were getting off in relatively orderly fashion. And he realized that's what he had to break. This veil of ignorance is what he had to tear down. That's why he wanted to write the report. There was one community that had not yet been dragged into the Nazi inferno, and that was the Jews of Hungary. And so he wanted his report to get to the Jews of Hungary, and it did. Within a day of him, the ink being dry, it is handed to the de facto leader of the Jews of Hungary. Verba's almost fantasy was that they would be shouting from the rooftops, telling the Jews, do not get on those trains. You are not being resettled for new lives in the East. You are being sent to your deaths. That's what he wanted, but it didn't happen. Reju Kastner, the leader of de facto leader of Hungarian Jewry, for a whole lot of reasons, which I again get into in the book, sat on that report. It stayed in a desk drawer. He did not pass it on to the Jews of Hungary who needed that warning. And that is one big reason why Rudolf Verba in later life was so bitter and so angry.
That is the, there are so many parts of this book where you have to put it down because you're so astonished. Where the hair is raising on the back of your neck. But that sequence that you've just outlined now was the point for me where my jaw was open, because Rudy had set off with three facts that he thought were unassailable. Three facts. One, people outside of Auschwitz don't know what's going on. Fact two, once the Allies find out about what's going on here, they will act. And fact three, once the intended victims of what is happening in Auschwitz find out, they will refuse. And all three of that, as you've just outlined, all three of those facts turn to dust in front of his eyes. I do want to ask you about the impact he did have, because he did.
Yes.
Because that report did have perhaps not the massive impact that he was hoping for, that he was prepared to put his life on the line for, but it did have an impact. Just tell us what you know,
yeah,
because there was some success there.
Yes, he had written that report to warn the Jews of Hungary, because he knew there was some, you know, more far in excess of 600,000 Jews of Hungary who had not yet arrived. And that was partly accounted for the urgency of the escape. As we say, it reached those sort of diplomatic capitals. There wasn't the immediate action, but it also, the report had its, you know, had took many parts. And one of them, and I say this partly because I'm a journalist, but thank God it did reach a journalist. It reached a British journalist in neutral Switzerland, where the press was freer of regulation and censorship. It reached a British journalist by the name of Walter Garrett, who realized the significance of this report straight away. And in what to me, what is a kind of incredible moment, I still picture it. So determined was he to get the story out. He didn't just sort of wire it to his news desk in London. He goes round on his bike in Zurich in the dead of night, handing copies of the story he's written, posting them through the letterboxes of all the newspapers in Zurich. The story gets out in late June of 1944. Remember, by then, it's nearly 2 months since Fred and Rudy have done their escape. By then, incredibly, 437,000, as it were, extra Jews have been killed since the escape, the Jews of the Hungarian provinces. But it gets out and it gets into the Swiss newspapers and from there around the world. And straight away, and this shows you the example, the importance rather, of information being public, it almost immediately, the Pope, who has known about this for some time, by the way, then now, once it's public and he's sort of shamed into acting, writes to the de facto leader of Hungary, the regent of Hungary, Admiral Horthy, and says, as the Holy Father, I am pleading with you to stop the deportation of these unfortunate people. He never says the word Jews. Roosevelt writes to Horthy in Hungary as well and says, got to warn you, if you're on the losing side of the war and you're involved in this deportation of Jews, you're going to be held for war crimes. That double warning makes Horthy, who has turned a blind eye to the deportation and murder of 437,000 Hungarians, now blows the whistle and says enough. And he halts the deportations that were just about to start from the capital, Budapest. And therefore, 200,000 Jews of Budapest who would have been deported and sent to the deaths in Auschwitz were not, because of the report written by 19-year-old Rudolf Erber and Fred Wetzler. And that is why they are responsible for the saving of 200,000 lives, which is why, I mean, what an unbelievable figure, which is why I say they belong right up there among the towering figures of the Holocaust. I mean, Oskar Schindler is is properly remembered for those 3,000 Jews on Schindler's list. We're talking 200,000 people as a result of this report. Now, Verbe himself did not beat his chest about this in later life and say, look at me, what a great hero, because he could not let go of the fact that there were 437,000 who did not get saved. And as far as he saw it, absolutely should have been. But 200,000 were.
Jonathan, I want to ask you a question about telling this story as the storyteller that you are. I interviewed Ron Howard last week for his movie 13 Lives, which tells the story about the Thai boys who were rescued from the cave, having been there incredibly for 2 weeks. And the story is told, this is a drama. It stars Viggo Mortensen and Colin Farrell, and it's full of Thai actors and so on. But it's told by someone, Ron Howard, who has also made very successful documentaries. And I wonder if you told that one of the reasons why this book is so powerful is that you are telling the story in the way that you do because, as well as being a Guardian journalist, you are a thriller writer. And so you are approaching telling this extraordinary story from a slightly different perspective to someone else who might have told this story.
Well, that's a lot. You know, look, obviously, I embrace that comparison. That's a really, really, you know, gratifying thought. I think it did help. Yeah, I didn't perhaps realize how much until I've seen the way people have responded to the book. But I have written 9 thrillers, and there's something about, I mean, you do this yourself, you know, there's something about the pacing of a thriller story where it's all about withholding knowledge, and, you know, you unspool the line bit by bit rather than just splurging it all out in one go. And this story, I think it demanded to be told in that way because it is properly thrilling. I mean, I didn't have to manipulate or sort of spin the history to make it feel like an exciting story. This is a 19-year-old boy who escapes or 19-year-old man who, together with his friend, escapes the tightest possible net that you could ever escape, and did it to warn the world. I mean, that is a truly heroic and adventurous thing. But yes, I did draw on, in a way, the kind of training, I suppose, in some ways, but the sort of lessons I'd learned from writing fiction. And so it is paced that way, and it's done without embarrassment that way. And I think what I've been really pleased by is a whole lot of people who don't normally read nonfiction, and a whole lot of people who don't normally read... wouldn't go anywhere near something about the Holocaust because they think that would seem too forbidding and sort of depressing, have instead said, look, I just couldn't stop. I couldn't put it down. I was turning the pages. I wanted to know what happened next. And I went into one bookshop to sign a few copies, and they said, the manager there said, you know, when people come in here and say, I like thrillers, what thriller do you recommend? The manager said to me, I'm recommending The Escape Artist. And, you know, I'm recommending a nonfiction book to people who say they want to read a thriller. I'm really pleased about that because I think, you know, this story, the Holocaust, needs to break out of just the kind of the readership that reads history books, and that also that can, you know, and that can, I think they have a sort of strong stomach to face a grim episode and a bleak episode in human history. I want it to be read by other people. And so far that does seem to be what's happening. And that is, you know, I'm really glad about that. And I'm partly glad about it, frankly, because Verbe himself did not get the recognition in his lifetime for what he had done. You know, I describe in the book that when he died in 2006, there were, you know, they had a memorial service and there was around 40 people there, no more. You know, he didn't have the, as I say, recognition that I think he did deserved. And so when people are reading this now and writing to me saying, what an absolutely extraordinary man he or men he and Wetzler were, what an incredible thing they did. You know, that feels to me as if a very small kind of wrong has been righted a bit in terms of him getting his due.
Jonathan, there's a central theme to this book, which you've touched on already in this interview, but I want to explore a little bit more, and that is deception. Now, there is clearly deception perpetrated by the SS against the victims even before they get on the trains. They're being sent, and I didn't know, I've read a lot of books about this subject, I didn't know about the postcards. So these are the postcards being sent to people back home saying, oh yes, we're resettled here in the East and everything's fine. And that was part of a deception to get people on the trains. And then the levels of deception within the camp to not make it clear what is going to happen to them the moment they come through those gates. I'd like you to talk about that, but I also would like to ask you about a second level of deception. I wonder whether there was a level of deception from the SS themselves towards deceiving themselves about what they were doing. Because we all know the excuses given afterwards of I was only following orders, or if I'd raised my hand and said this should not happen, I would have been the next to be shot, which it turns out was not true. They would just have been sent off to some other, well, bluntly, to fight in a battle where the enemy had a gun, as opposed to being an old lady or a small child. But they use those excuses all the same. And I wonder whether when they decided, you know, we're going to start blowing up the crematoria and the means of our genocide here only because they could hear the Red Army coming round the corner, that was actually a level of deception themselves. They were deceiving themselves. But would you mind addressing both of those? So the deception that the SS were carrying against the victims, but also whether you would agree that there was a level of deception they were perpetrating on themselves.
It's both such interesting questions. That second one, actually, especially, I haven't been asked that before, and I'm thinking about it as we're speaking. On the first point, you know, we were talking before about writing it like a thriller. I mean, just that as one small example on the, of that. When Rudolf Abel was first in one of those cattle trucks, on his way to what he didn't know was going to be a concentration camp, people on the in the cattle truck were talking about letters they'd got and were comparing notes on how oddly there were details that didn't make sense, where people would say, you know, mother sends her love, and the woman getting the letter would know that their mother had died 3 years earlier. Why is my brother referring to our mother as if she's alive? Or there would be references to, you know, people in the village who everyone knew had been gone 10, 15 years. These discrepancies, that's the sort of detail you might put in a thriller, because it turned out, of course, these were clues that people were deliberately smuggling into letters, knowing they were writing these letters at gunpoint, knowing they were about to die, and wanting to warn codedly the recipient something is not right. And at the time, the recipients didn't really understand what was going on, including Rudy himself. It's a detail that only makes sense much later on in the book, where you realise, okay, this is they were sending a signal. So, you know, again, I didn't have to work too hard to have almost these sort of quite thriller-esque plot details, you know, that you might have put in. The deception was meticulous from beginning to end. The language, you know, no one said you're going to go to gas chambers. They would say you're going for special treatment. You know, these euphemisms were used all the way through. The extent of lying, the thoroughness of it, down to, and it went to the very last moment. So even in the seconds before their death, they were being deceived. Jews, I think people know this, this is quite famous, that in one of the gas chambers, it wasn't in all of them, but in one of them, Jews would be herded into a room believing they were going to have a shower. There were fake shower heads in the ceiling, so that even in the final seconds, they thought water was going to come out, and of course gas instead was the room was filled with gas. The Germans understood something that it took, you know, Rudy himself understood, which is that if people have hope to the very last second, then they will comply. It's only if there is a complete absence of hope that they might start then panicking, stampeding. And Rudy didn't have any illusions. He didn't think the Jews were suddenly going to launch some armed revolt. These were children. They were the elderly. You know, 1 million children were killed in the Holocaust. We always have to remember that figure. These weren't people who could suddenly take up arms. All he wanted was for them to have that moment of panic and chaos, because he understood that the Nazi system required order. And if Jews suddenly started running in 25 different directions off the railway platform, that would they would all be shot dead in the end. But it would throw sand in the gears of the killing machine. So that's how central he understood, and he and the Nazis together, they both understood how important that deception was. That's why the Nazis went to such lengths, even faking postcards. As to whether they were deceiving themselves, that's interesting. They were certainly engaged in the business of Holocaust denial while the Holocaust was actually happening. You know, we think of Holocaust denial as something that happens years later. They were in that business at the time, keeping it secret. Auschwitz was chosen partly because it was a remote location. Same with the other death camps of Belzec and Chełmno and Sobibor. Far, you know, they're in faraway places where people won't have immediate knowledge. They are constantly hiding what they're doing. Again, documents that refer to, in euphemistic terms, to even the phrase itself, the final solution to the Jewish problem. It now is a chilling phrase. We know what it means at the time. Again, in some ways euphemistic. Whether they were actually deceiving themselves, the people doing the killing, almost in a psychological way, I'm not sure that it was that deception so much as the dehumanization there. They knew what they were doing because they were seeing it every day, the ones actually involved. But two things. First, they managed to dehumanize their victims. So the victims were never referred to really as people, but units, almost as if they were units of production in the factory. But second, I think, was the attempt to distance themselves from what they were doing. And that is in some ways why the gas chambers themselves were devised, because until then, there had been the so-called Holocaust of bullets, meaning Jews murdered in mass shootings, and that continued, by the way, right through the period, being shot into mass graves. Partly that was seen as just too stomach-churning a task for the SS men involved, whereas gas chambers allowed some distance. And it is telling that the people who actually did the work of operating the gas chambers, not administering the gas, but pulling the corpses out and so on, that was left to other Jewish prisoners. So that does suggest that they didn't want to face directly, too closely, the actual consequences of what they were doing. But those who were involved in it, they were able to get through it because they didn't believe their victims were human beings any longer. They were Jews, and therefore they were something other than human. And therefore they could look at a Jewish child aged 5 years old playing a ball with a ball or a doll and without hesitation herd them into a gas chamber to be murdered, and babies as well. You can only do that if you have decided those people are not people. And so I think, they were deceiving themselves in the sense they had decided these people were no longer human, and therefore what they were doing was not murdering their fellow human beings.
An impossible question to finish, Jonathan, but it seems worth asking you, and maybe just in a couple of minutes if you can, because you could probably fill hours on this. What lessons should we draw from your book?
I think the one that felt to me most pressing, and that in some ways accounted for why I went back to this story that I'd known when I was a 19-year-old, that I went back to all these years later, was really something about truth. As I was thinking about this, the word of the year was post-truth, fake news, people of Trump, etc. Rudolf Erber did everything and risked everything and risked, a very painful death because he was determined to get the truth out from underneath a mountain of lies. Because, as we've been saying, every stage of the process, of the Nazi killing process, involved lies. And he understood, in a way that I think is really relevant to our own time, that the difference between truth and lies can be the difference between life and death. It was because they were lied to that the Jews went to their deaths without panicking and stampeding and causing chaos. And that is, and then we look at the response to the evidence and how people, in some ways, we talked about the prejudice and the practical problems, but there was also an element of just sheer disbelief that people could not bring themselves to digest this terrible warning. And, the Holocaust is a unique and singular experience. I'm not making comparisons. When you look at our world now with our warnings about the climate crisis, and you think of that film Don't Look Up. I'd finished writing the book when Don't Look Up came out, but I saw that film and I could not help but think of Rudolf Erber, because he was coming to the world saying, banging the table saying, I have to warn you of something terrible, and people did anything to look the other way. They could not bear to hear what he was telling them. And I sort of think that maybe that isn't a Jewish thing, that isn't a Second World War thing. I think maybe that's a human thing, that we cannot absorb a warning that is too terrible to digest. And we find ways to not hear it. And that even happened with the handful of Jews who did get his warning. They sort of couldn't bear to take it in. It's very hard to contemplate your own imminent destruction. And I think that is a human impulse. I understand it. It may even be part of our sort of survival mechanism as a species. But I think we have to overcome it. And the best way to overcome it, perhaps, is to be conscious of it. And this story, the fate of the escape artist and his report, which he did so much to hand to the free world sort of thing, tells us why we have to overcome that human failing, in a way. It's a human weakness. But his story, I think, draws attention to it and perhaps gives us the equipment to overcome it.
Jonathan Friedland's book is The Escape Artist. It's essential reading, as I think you've just heard. Jonathan, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Matt.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Christopher Kimball, host of Milk Street Radio. If you'd like to change the way you cook and also think about food, please check out the Milk Street podcast. We travel around the world to find pizza in Tokyo, Egyptian food in Berlin, and Bhutanese farmers in Vermont. We speak to Jamie Oliver, Rachel Ray, Al Roker, Ina Garten, as well as Michael Twitty, Marcus Samuelson, and Alice Waters. And we'll introduce you to recipes that will change the way you cook, from bright pink Tottenham cake to Afghan dumplings to shoyu sugar steak, and that one is direct from Hawaii. It's a whole new world of food right here on Milk Street Radio. Please check us out on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts, or go to 177milkstreet.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.